Well, we now look forward to our brother Brian's words on thy maker is thine husband.
Thanks, Uncle Brian. Thanks, Brother James. It's nice to hear James talking tonight about husbands and wives, isn't it? I thought it was very appropriate, Chairman, to choose for tonight. Be very happy for you, James, and pray God's blessing on your plans ahead. Well, last class, of course, we covered the magnificent 53rd chapter. And the 54th chapter and the 55th are particularly a follow-on, you might call a tailpiece, as it were, from that servant song. That was the fourth servant song. If you come back just to the servant songs, you see that every time there's this flow-on. You get the song, then you get the tailpiece, so to speak. Look at chapter 42, where we have the first of those servant songs. You remember it was in verses 1 to 3, 1 to 4. But the next verses that follow, verses 5 to 9, very much related to what has gone past in the servant song. So you've got the song and then you've got some very direct material straight after that. Again, chapter 49. You've got the song, verses 1 to 6, and then you've got the follow-on in verses 7 to 13. And if you remember, all of that is very closely related to what is in the song. And so when you turn to chapter 50, it's the same. We had the song in verses 4 to 6, and then the verses that followed were again very, very closely related to that, verses 6 to 11. So it's very interesting, actually, just to see how in each case you've got, would you like to call it perhaps a commentary, picking up the essential issues and flowing through with that material. But of course, the greatest of all those four songs was chapter 52, verse 13, to the end of chapter 53 that we covered last time in the class before. And so the tailpiece, if we might call it that, is longer and more amplified because the great things have now been spoken. And so we could reasonably describe the whole of 54 and 55 as a direct follow-on from that great fourth servant song. Well, chapters 54 and 55 are really about response. There in chapter 53, there was this amazing piece of evidence that nobody had any idea was coming. I'm sure that's the case. I'm sure it was just as true in Isaiah's day when they heard him get up and say these words, that there was total unbelief almost as there was in the days of Christ. When reality came, Isaiah's words were now fulfilled in substance in a man, and he walked in their streets, he healed their lame, he did all kinds of miracles, and still they couldn't see that he was the one. What an astonishing thing. Well, I have no doubt that in Isaiah's day it was pretty similar. And when he said those words, there would have been all kinds of people that went home that afternoon and said, whatever did the prophet say today? How could he possibly mean what he has said in describing this man who eventually is going to actually pour out his soul unto death? And for what purpose? Why will that bring righteousness? Why does God need to do that? How could that possibly please the Lord? What does it mean he shall divide the spoil with the great? He's dead, isn't he? Isn't that what the chapter said? All those things, my dear and sisters, would have gone through their minds. It truly was a most startling prophecy. And it would have been remarkable for the people who heard it then, as it was in the day of its application. So in 54 now, the prophecy is given, the pith of the whole prophecy is given. Well, what's going to be the response? Well, the response is in chapter 54, verse 1. Sing, O barren, Thou that didst not bear. It's not often the barren sing, is it? But now they can. Everything's possible. Break forth into singing. This is not light language, is it? It's explosive language of joyfulness. Cry aloud. But thou didst not travail with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith Yahweh. Verse 2. Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitation. There's a great expansion going on. Children are coming in the most impossible manner from barren people. And there's so many of them that you just can't fit them in the habitation, in the tents. There's no place for them. Well, expand the tents. Increase the structures. So there's tremendous response. Invitation and response. Chapter 54, just picking verses as we're going along. 54 verse 11. Everything's possible. New vistas are created because of what this servant has done. O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest and not comforted. Everything will now be different. Behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colours and lay thy foundations with sapphires. Here's something tossed about, driven about with all the circumstances and the vicissitudes of life. Now, I'll lay thy stones with fair colours, this stability. There's foundations and beautiful foundations laid with precious stones. What a picture. Everything you see is possible. Because that servant has come and done that. If you're listening to Isaiah, you think, well, this is an incredible message. I cannot understand 53. I cannot see why God wants to do that. Does he really mean that? But look at the consequences. You'd have to take him seriously. Because God means great things through this one. 55 verse 1, another verse of great excitement. Everything's possible. Ho, everyone that thirsteth, wherever you are, whatever country, whatever kindred you come from, whatever race, everyone that thirsteth, it's all now possible. Come ye to the waters, and he that hath no money, come ye buy and eat. Yea, come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Can you buy wine and milk? Can you buy bread without money? Well, you can this bread. Or chapter 55 and verse 6. Again, a wonderful invitation. What will be the response? Seek ye Yahweh while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. And let him return unto Yahweh, and he will have mercy upon him. Isn't that lovely, my dear princes? Nothing too hard. Everything is now possible. It's all predicated, isn't it? The atmosphere has changed. It's risen. There's hope. There's every barrier is broken. There's no restraints anymore. Why? Because God's servant has come. And he's lived a righteous life. He's broken the bonds of death. And the gates are open. The opportunity is there for everybody. No matter how low, no matter how deep the depression, how far away the person or his country, it's all now possible. Or how wicked his condition might be, verse 7. What a wonderful, beautiful, inspiring a part of the prophecy this is. So here we have, you might say, singing for what another has accomplished in chapter 55. Or in chapter 55, it's chapter 54. Or in chapter 55, we have a feast for what another has paid. Just a neat little way to summarise those chapters. Singing for what another has accomplished, and a feast for what another has paid for. Or if you like to put it another little expression, chapter 54 is the comforting of Zion. The comforting of Zion. Chapter 55 is the universal call to enjoy those comforts. The comforting of Zion, the universal call. The universal call because it's everyone, never mind even if he were wicked, verse 7. So we have the comforting of Zion, chapter 54, and then the gates wide open, the universal call. Now that's not an absolute division of those two chapters, but it's a fairly neat way of grabbing hold of the sense of it, isn't it? It's not absolute distinction, because if you actually look in chapter 54, where do you find Zion referred to? Where is the name of Zion? Or can you see the name of Jerusalem there? It's not actually there, is it? It's not in chapter 54. And yet, that chapter is really all about it, which is quite interesting in itself. And the universal call of chapter 55 is not absolutely unique, because that's preempted in some of the passages that we have in chapter 54. For example, verse 5. The end of that verse, it says, "The God of the whole earth shall he be called." The clear implication of that is that God was going to have sons, not only of children of Abraham, but of all nations. So, there's a general description, the comforting of Zion, and the universal call to enjoy those comforts. But there are, of course, linkages. Someone else summarised it neatly like this. 54 speaks of the enlarging of their tents, and 55 tells us who will be in the tents. That's quite neat, isn't it? 54 tells us about the enlarging of the tents, and 55 tells us who will be inhabiting the tents. All right, come back now to our opening of our chapter. Our first stanza, verses 1 to 5. Zion's new and miraculous family. This is a really lovely section, my dear friends. It just keeps on rising. You know, if we had just this little section tonight, we could spend, you know, plenty of time all just in that section. It's just remarkable in its potential. And just keeps on building and building upwards as you think about it more. Verses 1 to 5, Zion's new and miraculous family. Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear. Does this follow chapter 53? Didn't we have a man in chapter 53? Sing, O barren, that's a woman. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child, because things have changed. For more are the children, the sons, the benim, of the desolate than the sons of the married wife, saith Yahweh. So this is not about a man. This is about a woman. Her children in verse 1, and verse 5, her husband. Thy maker is thine husband. Husband, his wife, sons, many sons. This is about a large family. So how then does it connect, perhaps? Well, he saw his seed, it said in chapter 53 in verse 10. There the seed were seen in the day in which he offered his life. And it says in verse 11, again repeating his vision at that time, he shall see of the travail of his soul. That's what happens in childbirth. But in his travail, he saw a great number of sons. He shall be satisfied. So many would there be that it would be a great encouragement for him. It's well worthwhile. This is a terrible course, but the results are satisfying. In verse 1, where we have, for more are the children of the desolate, it should be many more. The Hebrew is many more. And why do you think that pulls the connections together? Because, of course, in chapter 53, that was one of our words, wasn't it? The third to last line in verse 12 of chapter 53, he bare the sin of many. Many more are the children of the desolate. The word many was there again in verse 11. Towards the end of 53, verse 11, by his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many. And that's clearly the seed of verse 10. So link those down through. I don't know what you do with little things like that, but I just put a ring around them, push the pen up a bit and ring that one. It might seem a way of climbing through the chapter, but it's a very effective way of seeing immediately those links. And doesn't that bring it to light? What a beautiful sense that's bringing into the chapter. Clearly, there is the closest of connection between 54 and 53. Well, this woman was barren, but now she has great joy. She has not travailed, however, for that, and so her joy is all the greater, isn't it? Great would it be if the barren, in fact, had one child, and with travail. But if the barren has many more, and yet without travail, how much more does she sing and break forth into singing? So this is a miraculous work. Verse 1 is not the work of men, it's a miraculous work, a work of God. Clearly, Zion of herself, humanly speaking, is not able to bring that forth. It's a work in which God is involved. It's he that says that, saith Yahweh. Her sons are clearly the sons of the servant because of the connection of that sense. Although he knew what it was like to be, if you like, barren, for it says in verse 8 of chapter 53, he was cut off out of the land of the living, yet his seed were many. And his seed now are spoken of as Zion's children. Is that clear? His seed of chapter 53 are now being spoken of as Zion's children. Isn't that a beautiful sense? So the city and its king brought together very beautifully. He's going to be the redeemer under God of that people. Her seed are the sons of the servant. Now if you look at verse 1 again, of whom does that remind you? Well, it's got Sarah all over it, hasn't it? Indeed it is. For a Jewish community to receive words like that from Isaiah, they would have immediately thought of Sarah. We'll come back to words that we know so well and some that we don't perhaps know so well. Genesis chapter 11, where it tells us about Sarah for the first time. Isaiah said, "Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear." And Genesis 11 and verse 30 had said, "But Sarai was barren, she had no child." Chapter 16, verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children. And she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. But then when we turn another chapter, and verse 16 of chapter 17, it says this, "And I will bless her and give thee a son also of her." A son? "Yea, I will bless her, and there will be many more. She shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her." Isn't that beautiful? So, you know, that was the initial outworking of this kind of story, where the barren was going to have many more than Hagar, for example. And she would. So Sarah stands for Zion. Zion is prefigured, as it were, in Sarah. And where do you find that in the Bible? Isaiah is obviously doing that, but where is it actually put exactly like that? Galatians 4. Exactly like that. "For it is written," verse 22, "that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, Hagar, the other by a free woman, Sarah. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but he of the free woman was by promise," which things are an allegory. The two women and the issues that came were allegorical, speaking of greater things. "But these two are the two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai, which gendereth to bondage, which is Hagar. But this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth to Jerusalem, which now is in the apostolic time, and was about to pass away, and is in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all. For it is written," and here's our passage, "Rejoice, thou barren that bearest not. Break forth and cry, thou that travailest not, for the desolate hath many more children than she which hath an husband." Now Paul is just taking that passage straight out of Isaiah 54, and he's telling us that it's allegorized in Sarah, and it speaks of Jerusalem of the future. That's what he's saying, isn't it? It's put beyond question what 54 verse 1 means. Isn't that wonderful? You know, if we didn't have Galatians, we could have reasoned that out, couldn't we? But isn't it lovely to reason out first, then come over to the New Testament and say, "Oh, that's exactly what he's saying. Exactly what he's saying." So that Sarah becomes a type of Zion of the future. The prolific woman that brings forth many sons. We're going to see more about those sons as time goes. And just coming back now to Isaiah, can we feel again in chapter 51? Come back here just to chapter 51. Look what he said in verses 1 and 2. He really meant it, didn't he? "Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness. Ye that seek Yahweh, look unto the rock whence ye are hewn, and to the hole of the pit whence ye are digged. Look unto Abraham your father," just to Abraham, "and unto Sarah that bare you. For I called him alone, and blessed him and increased him." It's got the echoes of Genesis 17 verse 6 to it, hasn't it? And so now in this 54th chapter, all of that understanding is being beautifully, exultantly amplified. It's a delightful thing to read. So in the place of sadness, of barriers, of ineptitude, of loneliness, of solitude. There is now this expansive family. There are no limits. The barriers are taken away. And all the good things can come, and the expanse and growth of a vast family is possible because he poured out his soul unto death. What an amazing, amazing prophecy. Incredible revelation that was. But it was very, very clear. And the patriarchal sense is not lost in verse 2, is it? Enlarge the place of thy tent. Tent. Israel wasn't in Isaiah's days generally living in tents. But there's the little overture of Abraham and Sarah living in tents. Well, enlarge the place of thy tent. The things that were promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob through Sarah are now possible. Enlarge, therefore, the place of thy tent. And let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations. Lots of habitations. My father's house, the many habitations. Many abiding places. Spare not. Lengthen thy cords and strengthen thy stakes. You know what it's like with a tent. The bigger the tent gets, the stronger the tent posts have to be, don't they? You've got a little small tent like we used to have when we first married up there in the Flinders Ranges. Didn't need to have much stability to it, just two people. If you've got a big tent, you've got to have strength in those posts, don't you? And the bigger that gets, then the stronger the tent posts, I suppose. Hebron, you probably noted that as well this last weekend. What tent is this? We said there's some echo back to Abraham. But there is actually a tent, isn't there, in which the glory of God was placed. In Amos chapter 9, I'm sure this is related. We're looking to the future more than we're looking backwards. This surely is the passage that speaks about a tent. In that day, verse 11, in that day will I raise up the tent of David, the tabernacle of David, that is fallen, and close up the breaches thereof. And I'll raise up his ruins, and I'll build it as in the days of old. Now, there's not really going to be a tent set up in Jerusalem in the future, is there? It says it's going to raise up its ruins. A tent never really has ruins, does it? Might get blown over, but don't see ruins of it. What's the idea of this? Why does he speak in this way? What was David's tabernacle? Well, David made a tabernacle for the ark to come in, didn't he? The ark had been down in the house of Obed-Edom. He wanted it in Jerusalem. He couldn't imagine to have a capital city if God wasn't there. That had to be a unity of God and the king. Had to be in his mind. Well, the tabernacle of Moses was 10 or 20 miles north of that. He wanted God in Jerusalem. He had to have that. He could see the need of that. So he said, well, I'll build a tent. He pitched a tent. It says about that in 2 Chronicles chapter 3. I think it is in verse 1. Somebody might just check that. And the prophet Amos comes here and he picks up the specific fact that that's what David did. He says, I'm going to raise up the tabernacle of David. Why did David have that tabernacle? Well, because he wanted the ark to be there. Yes, but more than that. You see, anybody could come to that tabernacle of David, couldn't they? In that city of Jerusalem there were lots of other people who were not Jews. There were Philistines, for example. Ittai the Gittite and all of his family. Very large number of people have come with David. They needed to have some place where they could reach the God of Israel. They couldn't go to Moses' tabernacle. They were not allowed to go. So Amos says that in the future the tabernacle of David is going to be raised again. Why? Verse 12, that they may possess the remnant of Edom. And of all the heathen which are called by my name, saith Yahweh that doeth this. In other words, it was going to provide opportunity. That's the sense of it. God's not going to put up a tent in Jerusalem in the future. Not at all. But the institution of David that opened the doors for the Gentiles to come in and to be participants, some of their faith was greater than that which was in Israel. The Cherethites and Pelethites, men of tremendous loyalty and courage to David. Well, they're going to have a role because they're but symbols of all of the Gentiles, ourselves included, eh? Because we love the things that Jerusalem stands for. And those heathen are called by God's name, verse 12. And make a little note there, we're not going there because we haven't got time. But Acts 15, verse 16, applies that exactly as we have indicated. Peter stood up, didn't he, in the Jerusalem conference, and he applied it exactly like that. James did, sorry. Acts 15, verse 16 and 17. And if you think, well, would Isaiah be actually speaking about that? It's fairly specific. Just remember that in the 16th chapter of Isaiah, he too, as well as Amos, has referred to that specific item in history. In Isaiah 16 and verse 5, and in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. Now there is no question that he will not be sitting in a tent in Jerusalem, but the theme of that tent will surely be there. The institution of David will be in Jerusalem again. Now, that fits beautifully with the sense of Isaiah 53, many. This is the blood of the covenant which is shed for many, said Jesus, the remission of sins. And the many means not just Jews, but Jews and Gentiles. And if that's not clear in chapter 54, it's really clear in chapter 55. Ho, everyone that thirsteth. So, this tent is, if you like, symbolically represented by the tent of David, which is going to be greatly expanded, so that under its flanges there is room for as many as would come, uninhibited, from every direction. You can lift it up, you can let them come in. There were doors on every side of the tabernacle of David. They could come in. For it says again in verse 3, for thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. Now this is really the language of the patriarchs again, isn't it? Thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left. We just can't seem to get away, you see, from Abraham and that patriarchal sense. Keeping your hand there, look at Genesis chapter 28. Words spoken to Jacob. Verse 14 of Genesis 28. It's probable that this is a deliberate taking up of these words by the Spirit into Isaiah 54. Where it said, thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles. And thy seed, verse 14 of Genesis 28, thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth. Well, this is an expansive passage, just like the other one. And thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east and the north and the south, to the right and to the left. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now, isn't that absolutely, you know, the appositeness of that quotation is just beautiful, isn't it? It is absolutely the pith of what Isaiah is speaking. So that's why you can be comfortable in believing and seeing that this is taken, really lifted out of Genesis chapter 28. Come back again, though, to chapter 54. Did you notice the next little expression? It says, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles, and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. Thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles. Another translation? Your seed will possess even nations, which is more accurately translating it. Your seed, thy seed, will possess even nations. Write that down just so you can see the striking nature of the echo to the patriarchal period and the promises given to them. Your seed will possess even nations. Your seed, well, that's obviously the same seed as 53 verse 10. Same word, obviously the same sense. The servant's seed have become Zion's children. Point number two, your seed will possess. Where's the echo? Let me say it again. Your seed will possess. Well, it doesn't say the gate of his enemies, does it? But it's Genesis 22 and verse 16, isn't it? So there's another, verse 17. But that's clearly a little echo straight back to Genesis 22, verse 17. And they will possess even nations, possessing nations. What a dramatic thought that is. And that's very similar to chapter 52, verse 15, isn't it? As many were astonished at these, so shall he sprinkle many nations. He will be over even great nations. He'll possess the nations. Look at Psalm 2. It actually says the same thing. Possess the nations. Go well in our democratic world, wouldn't it, eh? Possess the nations. The anti-colonial days in which we live. Well, in Psalm 2 verse 8 it says, ask of me and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. You got the same language in Deuteronomy 9 verse 1, Deuteronomy 11 verse 23 and Joshua 23 and verse 9. So, coming back to 54 and verse 3, we have in verse 3 all the echoes of the best of their past glory, of the promises that were made, the exaltation that the people had to some degree as they came into the lands of the Gentiles and possessed their land, possessed them. And that's now mingled with the seed of the servant, the sons of Zion. They will take it up and expand that theme as never before seen. So this is rich. It's very rich and beautiful language, resting upon the ancient things that God had spoken to this special people. Verse 4. Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded or humiliated. For thou shalt not be put to shame. Now, how many times do you have to say it? It said it and said it and said it again. Over and over, spilling over. In other words, never again will shame come your way. For thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood anymore. What an affirmative statement that is. The old times are gone. New times have come. And spilling over each other, ashamed, confounded, put to shame, or one upon another, or never again will that come as Zion's way. What a beautiful thing. Do you know what the paper said today? What did the paper say today about Jerusalem? And the great quarrel about Jerusalem. 50 people have been killed just in recent times. Brother Allen mentioned on Sunday morning that there was it 10? 15. Now the paper said 50 people and 1,000 injured. How about that? The worst riots, the worst troubles for 4 years in Israel. Most of those slain are Palestinians. They get their name from the word Philistines, and they say Jerusalem is ours. What do they know about this passage? What do the Jewish people know about this passage? How will they get Jerusalem? What's the basis? Chapter 53, isn't it? No entrance into Jerusalem unless you accept my son and appreciate what he has done. I've written it, I couldn't make it plainer. The singing, the breaking forth, the taking away of the barriers was after the work of my son. You accept him and you can have that. You don't accept him, you will never have that city while you have that presence. What a powerful thing that is. What's this youth and this widowhood in verse 4? Well, perhaps we could say the shame of their youth was the treatment they got in Egypt. And perhaps we could say the reproach of thy widowhood was when Zion was left like a widow with charred ruins, broken walls, and the people were carried off into Babylon. But the essence of the verse is that in all of their total experiences in life, whatever shame, confounding and humiliation has gone and they can't even remember it. So good, so blessed, so happy are the new times that they can't even remember that which has gone before. This is a phenomenal redemption. And what is the grounds of this? Why such redemption? Why such total difference? For, verse 5, this is the answer. Thy maker is thine husband. Barren woman, and she has this tremendous breaking forth of joy on every side. Why? Thy maker is thine husband. He's part of the family. Who is this? Yahweh of hosts is his name. What a beautiful, beautiful thing that is. You know, it takes a while to really think what you're reading, doesn't it? It's saying, thy husband is thy maker. No other husbands are the makers of their wife, are they? But in this case, this woman's husband is her maker. She wouldn't be unless it were for him. And that's why there's such superlative and assuring confidence about these matters. Because he's the very maker of her. She wouldn't exist with it if it wasn't for him. In the 51st chapter and verse 13, we had reference to God as maker. And forgettest Yahweh, thy maker. Beautiful expression, isn't it? We forget that sometimes, don't we? You know, he made the fish, he made the birds, but he made us too. We wouldn't exist if it wasn't for him. He's our maker. Psalm 95, beautiful psalm. You might remember that Isaiah 51, that little section that we just referred to there, has probably its roots in Psalm 95. Remember that? There was a whole lot of little echoes back to Psalm 95. Quickly then back to Psalm 95. He made lots of things. Yahweh is a great God and a great king above all gods. In his hand are the deep places of the earth, 95 verse 4. Yes, we understand that. He made the world. Strength of the hills is his also. Yes, nothing's beyond him. The depths of the sea is his and he made it. His hands formed the dry land. Yes, he's maker of all those things. Oh, come, let us worship and bow. Let us kneel before Yahweh, our maker. Think of that when you go to bed tonight and give thanks for all you've got, that he actually made us. Made all those things, didn't he? But did he make you and me? Beautiful thing. He is our God, the sheep of his pasture. In chapter 44 of Isaiah, just make a little note there, but the same language is there. So this is a This is an expression of the prophet of Isaiah. He loves that expression, thy maker. And here it is, thy maker is mine, thine husband. Well, who was that then? Well, the prophet then says, beautifully, Yahweh of hosts is his name. Yahweh. Where did that name come from? Well, it was given, wasn't it, in Exodus 3. And remember how we, in several of our recent classes, have gone back to Exodus 3 and Exodus 6 in particular, and shown that Yahweh was a God of redemption. And that sixth chapter really emphasized that, didn't it? How he would do this and this and this and this and this and this. I am Yahweh, and do this and this and this. I am Yahweh. And he would redeem them. That's what he would do. That's what he's clearly showing them. He will. Ayah. And what he would do is redeem that people. Thy maker is thine husband. And he's had as old a connection with you as that. Yahweh. Not just Yahweh, but Yahweh of hosts. He's prepared to put his power into effect. Yahweh of armies is his name. And did we say that it was a name of redemption? The Redeemer. But here's an amazing thing. Whilst he's Redeemer, he's still yet the Holy One of Israel. He is righteous, yet justifying the unrighteous, is Paul's expression in Romans chapter 3, I think verse 28. That he might be just and the justifier of him that believeth in Jesus. This one's a redeemer, and yet he is still the Holy One of Israel. There was no tension between those two thoughts. His holiness could prevail, and yet he could still bring Israel to him without a compromise of his integrity, of his holiness. And if you think that's wonderful, that he can bring Israel back to him, the next thing is even more startling. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. Isn't that lovely, my dear brothers and sisters? This is grand language. I don't know how you find words to express the enormity of this language. It just flows and flows and gets greater and greater. It just fills your heart with the breadth and the depth of it all. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. What a grand and glorious thing. Just quickly, back to 42. Where that thought was placed against the background. Verse 5. The servant, verses 1 to 4. Verse 5, thus saith Ael, Yahweh, he that created the heavens and stretched them out, he that spread forth the earth, God of all the earth, and that which cometh out of it, course, it's all his. He that giveth breath unto the people upon it, spirit to them that walk therein. Well, of course he'd have to be a God, not only to the Jews, but also to the Gentiles, right? He'd have to be. Why? Well, he created it all. So he will keep thee and give thee, verse 6, for a covenant of the people, for a light of the Gentiles. See? It's just a natural corollary from the fact that he created all the earth. So the God of the whole earth shall he be known. I'd like to just put that to John 4. Just quickly flick over to John 4. When Jesus was in the area of Samaria, he sensed that same thing. And the people sensed the same things. And they said in verse 42, John 4, now we believe, not because of the saying, thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves and know that this indeed is the Christ, the Saviour of the world. They sort of sense the same thing that's being so beautifully expressed. There's no barriers. The tent is wide open to east, west, north and south. 4 verse 6. And in verse 6 we begin this new section. Just to give you the heading of verse 6, this is my heading. Verses 6 to 10 it is. The marriage restored. The marriage restored. Do you make a covenant in marriage? The marriage restored in an eternal covenant of peace and love, or kesed. The marriage restored in an eternal covenant of peace and kesed. Well, this section too is closely related to its context. It's about marriage, for Yahweh hath called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit and wife of youth. You remember just back in chapter 50, that's what it was talking about. Verse 1 and 2, thus saith Yahweh, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement whom I have put away, or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? Zion was complaining that she was unwanted and cast aside. Well, he says, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement? Show it to me. Behold, for your iniquities have you sold yourselves, and for your transgressions is your mother put away. So chapter 54 now is the answer to those things. We have a direct link with that. And as in marriage there is a covenant, so verse 10 speaks about the covenant of my peace that will never be removed. Covenant of my peace. You see, peace is now possible because, connecting again, 53 and verse 5 is said that the chastisement of our peace was upon him, shalom. The chastisement of our peace, our reconciliation, bringing us to God, was made by him. And now it's possible that we can have a covenant of my peace, says God. So you've got these very important linkages that so beautifully bring the whole prophecy, tighten it all up together. So in verse 6 we have a call to an errant woman that God wants to bring back for himself. The implication perhaps is that he's forsaken her. Yahweh hath called thee as a woman forsaken, and thou wast refused. But really, that's not the right emphasis. The word forsaken really just means left. And it makes it clear back in the 50th chapter that she was justly left. The blame is not upon her husband, her maker, but upon her. But it was sad. It was very sad, and God felt that sadness. As a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit. And a wife of youth. You know what Proverbs says about that in chapter 5. There is the delightful intimacies of that first and only woman. The wife of youth. There was a bond that was special and privileged. And it says again in Malachi, doesn't it, in chapter 2. Deal not treacherously with the wife of thy youth. There was something special, very special signal about that. Well, it's gone. There is something grievous about that. Is God not going to be related to the tragedy of that? As he had this relationship with Zion of old, and now we'll just forget it as though it never ever happened? Why, not even a man can do that. Will God allow that? He remembers and he acts. And he reminds, just gently but beautifully, that this is coming from thy God. See into verse 6. Saith thy God. He is touched by this. And there's going to be a restoral. Now that restoral is beautifully spoken about by the contemporary prophet in Hosea. Hosea chapter 3. This is a chapter that's so akin to this. Again, we won't be stopping here, but I just thought we should at least make the point. Verse 1, then said Yahweh unto me, go yet love a woman beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress according to the love of Yahweh toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love flagons of wine, but he loves them still. See? According to the love of Yahweh. And here you've got it expressed so beautifully. This woman, unto this very day, is still having her flagons of wine, so to speak, with the world. But here is God's call to her. And in the following verses, 7, 8 and 9, we have very beautiful reassurances. Very beautiful reassurances. I think these words, 7, 8 and 9, are some of the most beautiful words in all of Isaiah, perhaps in all of the Bible. Just glorious words. And they're linked. See verse 7, you've got the word moment. Not a very common word, but it's in verse 8. And you see that in verse 8 you've got the word wrath. And a little wrath. And in verse 9 you've got the word wrath in the last, second last line of that. So you can see these are grouped together. They're linked together. And there's a very clear echo to other passages of Isaiah, which we'll just come to in a moment. But in a moment. Small moment. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, says God, but with great mercies will I gather thee. So the greatness of his compassions, as that word mercies means, it's not the word chesed, it's the word compassions or bowels. You know, when the child was brought to the two women in Solomon's day, the bowels of the mother were just yearned for the child, and she had to say, give it to the other person. She couldn't possibly live with the taking of its life. So here we have the greatness, the extent of God's compassions. Verse 8 is really emphasizing the endless nature of it. In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment. But with everlasting chesed will I have mercy on thee, saith Yahweh, thy Redeemer. We've had Redeemer in verse 5. He can't but say it again. But isn't verse 8 a most beautiful verse? You think of the tragedy of 2,000 years of history, of the brutal Romans that spread them all over the earth, or the Babylonians before that. Or the Holocaust, my dear brothers and sisters. And God says, in a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment. Well, that, what will be the size of the great mercies? Or what the enduring nature of the everlasting chesed that God will give to them in the future? Saith Yahweh thy Redeemer. These are incredible verses. They really are, aren't they? And verse 9 stresses the permanence of that arrangement. For this is as the waters of Noah unto me. What does he mean by that? Well, the waters came and the waters went. There was a time when God drew a line and said, no more. This is as the waters of Noah unto me. For as I have sworn unto that the waters of Noah should no more go upon the earth, so have I sworn that I would not be wroth with thee nor rebuke thee. There's a line drawn, and when that has been accomplished, that's the end of it. And God that brought those judgments always yearned that he might come to them like a husband would for his treasured wife of his youth and bring her to himself. So God, in the most expressive of language, is saying that's how he feels about Zion and the people of that city. What an incredible piece of language. As the waters of Noah. Come back and just remember what it just says about the bow and the cloud in Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 13. With every living creature, verse 10, that is with you, of the fowl of the cattle, of every beast, from all that go out of the ark, to every beast of the earth, I'll establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood. This is as the waters of Noah. Neither shall there any more be a flood to destroy the earth. Isn't this grand, my dear brothers and sisters? The exactitude of the comparison is beautiful. And God said, this is the token of the covenant which I have made between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. Permanence was the note of our verse 9. For perpetual generations I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. Beautiful, beautiful language. Well, this is the waters of Noah and domain. You know, within the context of this great servant prophecy, that was the first note that was struck. Do you remember in chapter 40? In chapter 40, just shows you, we're right in the heart of it, because this was the first note that was struck in chapter 40. Comfort ye. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished. Her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of Yahweh's hand double for all her sins. It's not that she's a better person just yet, is it? She hasn't really repented of her ways, but God wants her back and he's going to have her back because his compassion has been moved toward her. But while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And this is the way God acts. True, they will recognize the servant of chapter 53 in the day to come. But the compassion of God will be the instigating force. And that will go forward and the other will yet come. For the mountains, verse 10, shall depart and the hills be removed. Not that they would literally, that's not the point at all. But they'll be moved and they'll go before my kindness. And that's Kesed again. Shall not depart from me. And I say kesed because I think we all know, don't we, what that word means. It doesn't just mean mercy, but it means everlasting mercy. Steadfast love is how the RSV puts it. It's got both those qualities. Love, yes, but not something changing, but something permanent, enduring, loyal. Loyal love. So let's read it again. For the mountains shall depart and the hills be removed, but my kesed shall not depart from them. Neither shall the covenant of my peace, the chastisement of his peace, of our peace, was upon him. It will never be removed. My dear friends, isn't that just beautiful? In the end, that's going to apply to the children of Abraham. This family is broader than Abraham's direct seed, obviously. But in the end, it's going to apply to them. Can you see that, people? So much in love with the things of God and with the Son that he sent and that they refused. What an incredible change is to come into their hearts. They are moving people. One of the greatest things ever in history will be the repentance of Israel, surely. To come into the context of such words as this. What movement, what power, what a glory to see that. What tears, what expressions of repentance. What a sense of chagrin that they've made this mistake all these long years. And they've lost all these generations. Incredible thing. Neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith Yahweh, that hath mercy on thee. Compassions, that's the same word as what you've got, mercies in verse 7. Then follows, my dear and sisters, the glory and beauty and security of the New Jerusalem. The glory, the reality, the beauty and the security of the New Jerusalem. O thou afflicted, tossed with tempests, my word, what a statement. Is that not an accurate reference to Jerusalem and all of her children? Whether they be the natural seed or the spiritual seed. How many of our people have been tossed to the lions or judged unto death or been afflicted by a wicked church? O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest and not comforted. Comfort ye my people. See, we're right on the line, aren't we? Why this very prophecy was given. Behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colours and lay thy foundations with sapphires. Tossed no longer, on sure foundations, solid and beautiful. And I'll make thy windows of agates and thy gates of carbuncles, beautiful stones, and all thy borders of pleasant stones. And all thy children shall be taught of Yahweh. You know, that's where Revelation 21 is founded upon. If you're just wondering, just keep your hand there very quickly. Look at Revelation 21. What's Revelation 21 about? The New Jerusalem, which came down from God. It wasn't bricks and mortar tumbling down out of heaven, was it? I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven. Verse 2. Prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Now look at that language. Where do you think that's all coming from? That's straight out of our Isaiah, isn't it? Straight out of it. What an incredible book Isaiah is. I've heard a great voice out of the heavens saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And again from Isaiah in verse 4, wipe away all tears from their eyes. 25 verse 8 it comes from. For the former things are passed away. It's exactly the same picture. On the one hand it's the bride, on the other hand it's the city. That's exactly what Isaiah 54 is about. A woman, once barren, now she has a husband. He's got limitless power. And he can make her and redeem her. And then she's seen as a glorious city. Beautifully arrayed with pearls and all kinds of precious stones. And that's how it goes on to speak of this one, isn't it? Look at verse 18. The building of the wall of it was of jasper. The city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. He mentions all the stones in verse 19 and 20, see? And 12 gates, because they're on every side. You can come from any direction, east, west, north, south. You can enter in. Lots of literal city. But it finds its roots, I'm sure, in Isaiah 54. What a chapter. All right, coming back now. It then said in verse 13, in this day of glorious establishment and beauty, it said, and all thy children, thy sons, shall be taught of Yahweh. Now what's that make you think about? Do you know someone here who was taught of Yahweh? Who was that who was taught of Yahweh? Just a few chapters back. Morning by morning. He was taught of Yahweh, wasn't he? All thy children shall be taught of Yahweh. As he, so them. They're in the same family, the same father, the same mother. And they've found their redemption through his arm, an extension of himself. Isn't that beautiful, my dear brothers and sisters? By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, and they will have his knowledge. As we've said many times, nothing could be more inspiring to the teaching of our children. If you've got young children, teach them. Don't bend the word of God. Teach them. Put it in their hearts and their minds. Solid, good things. So they can see what's right and see what's wrong. And great shall be the peace of thy sons. That's exceedingly beautiful. See the word sons, it's the word benim. And the word stones is the word ebed.
Sons are like stones. Some others might be. That's true. That's great. You can see what that's saying, can't you? So you put one stone upon another and you build a city. And you put one son upon another and you build a family. They're related in the Hebrew. The sense is related.
The word to build is related to that word as well. So here it switches, you see, from a family to a city, to a city to a family. Isn't it lovely? Just absolutely beautiful the way it does that. Great, therefore, shall be the peace, the shalom of thy sons. Whose sons are these, my dear brothers and sisters? Isn't this a collective picture of the sons of God? That's what it is in essence, isn't it? This is the sons of God. It was the Son of God that brought them to this position. But they in him have received sonship. They are brothers together with him, sons together of this Maker, Yahweh of hosts. So in the following few verses, in righteousness shalt thou be established. In righteousness shalt thou be established. As it said in chapter 53, my righteous servant shall make righteous many. 53 verse 11. When that's been accomplished, the fruits of it are seen. In righteousness shalt thou be established. It's based upon what he did. Thou shalt be far from oppression, for thou shalt not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near thee. In chapter 51 it spoke about terror. And the oppressor, 51 verse 13. And God there in 51:13 spurned those aggressive instincts of others. As though they never existed, because he could see this picture. When they wouldn't exist. When everything that was against the sons of God would be taken away. Can you, in fact, bring down the sons of God? Behold, they shall surely gather together, but not by me, like they did in the days of Ahaz, when Ephraim was confederate with Syria. They gathered together. But God is gathering, verse 7. But with great mercies will I gather thee. They can't infringe upon his gathering. And he's not gathering them. Against his people? Behold, they shall surely gather together, but not by me. Got nothing to do with me. It's not my will. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall for thy sake. Remember Psalm 2? Let us come together against Yahweh's anointed. Behold, I have created the smith that bloweth the coals in the fire, and that bringeth forth an instrument for his work. and I have created the waster to destroy. So if God creates the smith, the man who makes the weapons, then what weapon can be formed against him? What's this sounding like, my dear brothers? The sons of God against whom there is no weapon, against whom no one can bring condemnation. What's that make you think of in the New Testament? It's Romans 8, isn't it? No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, none of them. Who can bring something against God's elect? And every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment, a term referring to bringing people in court of law, to judgment. No tongue shall rise against thee in judgment. Thou shalt condemn, as it was for the Son, in chapter 50, the very same language. He is near that justifieth me, verse 8 of chapter 50. Who will contend with us? With me. Let us stand together. Who is mine adversary? Let him come near to me. Behold, the Lord God will help me. Who is he that shall condemn me? Lo, they all shall wax old as a garment. The moth shall eat them up. And the same spirit and the same security and assurance is there for all the children, all of Zion's children. God's protection is with us. Never mind how it might seem. This divine guidance through every vicissitude is the heritage, the ownership, the reality of possession. This is the heritage of the servant. Do you know that Isaiah doesn't have the word servant in his book anymore? It's always servants from here on. After 53, it's always servants. This is the heritage of the servants. What he had, they received. His security is their security. And their righteousness is of me. That is, it comes from me. It is of near to me. As he said in chapter 51, my righteousness is near, my salvation has gone forth. This is the heritage of the servants of Yahweh, and their righteousness is of me, saith Yahweh. Just in conclusion, Romans 8. You almost hardly need to turn the page. It's all the same language. Its roots are in Isaiah 50 to 54, very beautifully. He's bringing many sons unto glory. He might be the firstborn, verse 29, among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, he justified. Whom he justified, he glorified. What shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? He that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all. How shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? It is God that justifieth. Isaiah 50 verse 8 and 9. Who is he that condemneth? Isaiah 50 verse 9. Isaiah 54. It is Christ that died, yea, rather that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God, who also maketh intercession for us. Isaiah 53, verse 12. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, distress, persecutions, famine, nakedness, perils, or sword? Tossed to and fro, afflicted, as it is written, for thy sake we are killed all the day long, we are counted as sheep for the slaughter. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord.